But I just think it's an inevitable consequence of a system which depends upon, you know, people buying the vaccines as fast as they possibly could, rather than a fair distribution system.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. Hey, I've started a new newsletter because so many people say they don't know what media to follow or what's truth or what's disinformation. So check it out. I mean, it generally gives you the kind of the, you know, top five stories of the day. It just tells you what you need to be following. DanaLewis.substack.com. And what I try and do is write a little bit and then also give you the links if you want to read the original sources. On this backstory, vaccine wars. An EU vaccine blockade of Britain? Both sides accusing the other of arrogance, of mishandling the international call for vaccines in this pandemic. Now, Britain initially surged ahead in vaccines, but now the EU is clawing back vaccine supplies, putting the European Union countries ahead of the United Kingdom. In meantime, poorer countries may not have vaccines for several years, if at all. As COVID-19 mutates, the countries which hoarded supplies may find themselves having to vaccinate populations again and again, as the vaccines they have may no longer work. The US has 1.2 billion vaccines, enough to vaccinate its population twice, while just across the border, Canada has suspended AstraZeneca because of blood clot concerns. It's way behind in vaccinating Canadians. And Ontario reports variants are infecting younger people and their illnesses becoming more severe as the COVID variants adapt. And that's people in their 20s. Backstory on the race to vaccinate.
All right, Dave Keating is the Brussels correspondent for France 24, and he is not in Brussels right now. He's in the U.S., but he's normally based covering all that moves in the European Union. So we welcome him, and thank you, Dave, for your time.
Glad to be here.
Is there a vaccine war between the EU, the European Union, and Britain?
There is certainly one developing. I mean, the origins of this lie in the EU's dispute with AstraZeneca, because the EU is angry that AstraZeneca isn't meeting its delivery commitments to the EU. So we know that for the first quarter, AstraZeneca will meet one third of the schedule that it was supposed to deliver. And it looks like for the second quarter, it'll meet about half. And so because AstraZeneca is a UK-based company, and in the EU says, or the European Commission says, that in its contract with AstraZeneca, the two production facilities in the UK were supposed to be used to be part of the EU supply chain. Basically, the EU's complaint is they think that AstraZeneca is giving the UK preferential treatment. And indeed, UK ministers and AstraZeneca CEO have said that their arrangement between the government and AstraZeneca as some kind of Britain first arrangement, so that British people are supposed to get the doses of AstraZeneca first before anyone else. And that's why no exports can be happening. The EU says that it was not aware of any such Britain first arrangement when it signed its contract with AstraZeneca. And indeed, they say that in the contract, AstraZeneca said it had no prior arrangements with other countries that would prevent it from meeting its delivery schedule to the EU. So essentially, it's a kind of proxy war. The specific dispute is between the EU and AstraZeneca, but it's spilled over into a conflict with the UK government.
I mean, right now, for instance, one of the headlines in The Express today is EU vaccine blockade. Macron gloats about the UK's dependence on us. Jabs are not, in capital letters, not leaving the block. I mean, there are those in Britain that will turn it into kind of a Britain versus France tug of war, and a very political one.
For sure. And French leaders have been among the most vocal on this. What Macron and ministers are referring to, Thierry Breton, the Internal Market Commissioner, also said something similar yesterday. They're talking about the Pfizer exports. So we know that 21 million vaccine doses made at facilities in the EU have been exported to the UK since the start of the vaccination campaign in December. We understand that the vast majority of that is Pfizer. And meanwhile, as I was just mentioning, no doses made. The UK only, AstraZeneca is the only vaccine maker that at the moment is producing vaccines in the UK, and none of those have left the UK. So the idea that the French government is trying to say is essentially, you guys have depended on these Pfizer exports from the EU for your very successful vaccination campaign so far. And if the EU were to cut off those exports, the UK would, if you just look at the figures, you know, the UK would really be in trouble. There's no way that they could meet their target of offering the vaccine to all adults by July if they suddenly lose the access to the Pfizer vaccines.
I mean, there is big concern and growing concern in Britain that, you know, are the second doses going to arrive? And French officials have said it's a bit like the grasshopper and the ant. Instead of keeping the second dose, they, the British, preferred to give the first dose to everyone without reservation. I mean, they're sort of blaming the British for rushing to give the first dose without knowing that they would have the supply of the second one. Is that reality?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the concern about the UK strategy. It is an outlier strategy in that, particularly for Pfizer. So Pfizer, the recommended interval between doses is 4 weeks, and the UK has gone with 12 weeks. And in EU countries, for the most part, they have been saving the second dose to give to the person 4 weeks later, whereas the UK had a strategy of giving out first doses as soon as they were received, and as far as we can tell, not saving any. And that, of course, was due to the fact that we know that a first dose can be very effective in keeping someone out of hospital. So the rationale behind that was you get as many people getting that first shot as possible to keep them out of the hospital, and that it can be a calculated gamble. But of course, the gamble was always that what if you have supply problems later on when people are due to get their second dose? And that could be what we're entering into now.
I've had my first dose of AstraZeneca here in London, and I think the second dose now is sometime in May. It will be very interesting to see what happens to the supply. So, look, there's a lot of politics at play here, right? Because the Brits, after initially bungling the lockdown, having some of the highest death rates in the world, turned around and saw the vaccines as rescuing some political careers here as well. And they said the EU got it wrong. And by leaving the EU because of Brexit, Britain got it right. And it gave them ground to boast, and also to say that the EU, you know, was this big clumsy 27-nation bloc that couldn't sign contracts fast enough and just too bad for the EU. What is the EU?
Yeah. Exactly. I think that kind of communication that we had from the UK government and UK media over the past 4 months has not helped this situation. Clearly, government ministers have wanted to gloat about this, and they've wanted to connect this to Brexit. That connection was always a bit tenuous because all of the decisions that the UK made last year were made while it was still under EU rules. Any EU country could have given earlier national approval to the vaccine, and any country could have opted out of the joint procurement. So the UK hasn't done anything technically that it couldn't have done as an EU member. Of course, you could say de facto, it would have been hard for the UK to have such an independent approach as an EU member state. That hasn't stopped it in the past. But I think, yeah, that kind of very aggressive language with ministers saying, look at us, look at how great we are, look how bad the EU is doing, that really angered people in Brussels at a time when relations between the UK and the EU are at their absolute most sensitive point, because the UK just left the EU single market on the 1st of January, and there's all kinds of negotiations going on now. So certainly it gave domestic political benefit for the government to talk about the AstraZeneca vaccine as a British vaccine and hailing this as a huge triumph for the nation, and talking about, you know, the first person getting their dose was William Shakespeare. And I think it got a little carried away, and the government was thinking just about a domestic audience and not how that could be impacting international relations and their very, very sensitive relations with the EU right now.
It was embarrassing. I mean, where you are in particular, it was embarrassing the French government, especially.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, it has been difficult for Europeans to see people getting vaccinated so quickly in Israel, the UK, and the US, while they are not. You know, I'm an American living in Belgium. My parents have had the vaccine. My sister-in-law has had the vaccine. Lots of my friends have. I don't even know someone who knows someone in Belgium who's received a vaccine. That's how early Belgium is in its campaign. But of course, I think we should keep things in perspective because of course, when you're comparing to Israel, UK, and US, EU countries, most of them look quite slow with the exception of countries like Denmark and Malta, which are going quite fast. But in fact, if you look at a global comparison, the EU is still well ahead of most countries, including developed countries like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea. So it's actually the exceptional thing here is not the EU's quote unquote failure, it's the exceptional performance of this handful of countries, about five of them that are ahead of the EU, including Israel, UK, US, Chile has done quite well, Serbia. But those are kind of the exceptional ones because of course the vaccine became available much, much faster than we were expecting. I mean, as late as September, we were being told don't expect a vaccine till April. It's not even April yet. So basically, a couple countries were really good at adjusting to the new reality as we found out the vaccines were going to be available much, much faster than we originally anticipated. And as French President Macron has acknowledged, EU countries were slow to recognize that new reality that the vaccines were going to be ready much faster. And that's, I think, a big part of the difference in comparison between those handful of exceptional countries and the EU countries.
Dave, last question to you. Do you think as they scrap over the vaccines, because in essence, that's what's going on, that the reality that, you know, more than 80 countries have not received any vaccines at all, that a lot of these vaccines are going to be outpaced in around the world, including maybe in America and in Europe, by a virus that keeps changing so quickly that really we're just in the first chapter of this.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this explains a lot of the EU's behavior right now. They're thinking ahead because, you know, there's been a lot written about how much can the EU threatening a vaccine export ban, I mean, how much is that really going to benefit EU citizens in the short term? Not much, but they're thinking ahead because we are looking probably at a situation with new vaccines every year, maybe even more often, mm-hmm. and maybe some being necessary much quicker than that in the next couple of months with new variants. And what we've seen in these past months is the EU feels that it's been kind of outplayed by Washington and London, and it wants to make sure that that's not going to continue being a feature of the vaccination campaigns. And so very much they are looking ahead to those future waves of vaccinations. And, you know, this is, as EU leaders like to say, very often this is a marathon, not a sprint. And some of the early success here, as you say, could end up being fleeting. This is a long war and against the virus and future viruses. And this first phase, the past 4 months of the first vaccinations, is really just the first battle.
Dave Keating, Brussels correspondent with the French television network France 24. Thank you so much. I appreciate all your time.
Thanks.
All right, joining me from, I believe he's in London, is Nick Dearden, who is the director of Global Justice Now, campaigning for the fair distribution of vaccines. Hi, Nick. Nice to meet you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
What is the raison d'etre of Global Justice Now? I mean, it's just not about vaccines.
It isn't. I mean, we have existed actually since 1970, so we're over 50 years old now. And we exist to try to create a fairer international economy. We think there are many, many aspects of the global economy which fuel poverty, fuel inequality, fuel climate change, fuel conflict, and we want to change that. So we have a better chance for everybody in the future.
But it's a non-profit NGO.
That's correct. It is, yes.
Okay, let's talk vaccines. So 85 countries will not have widespread access to coronavirus vaccines before 2023. Does that sound right? And what is the problem with that?
That's how it looks at the moment. And look, what happened here was we we've had a pharmaceutical sector that's been a real problem, really very dysfunctional for a long time now, which has the wrong incentives hardwired into the system, if you like, but precisely because of intellectual property rules at a global level. And so we knew this was going to be a potential issue from, you know, 18 months ago or so. And that's why the World Health Organization set up a number of bodies, including COVAX, to help distribute vaccines fairly around the world. Sadly, rich countries like my own then decided they were going to bypass these mechanisms, buy up all the vaccines that were going to come onto the market, and leave most of the world with very, very few. They kind of pursued vaccine nationalism, and you know, Britain now has several times the vaccines it needs or will do by the end of the year to vaccinate its entire population. Same with Canada, same with many other countries.
Well, let's start with Britain, yeah. Since you mentioned it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Britain set up through Oxford University with AstraZeneca, and that is now the AstraZeneca vaccine. It was supposed to be non-profit, was it not?
Initially, yeah. So that's right. Yes, the AstraZeneca vaccine, or the Oxford University vaccine, was created with huge amounts of public resource. And of course, Oxford is in many ways a public institution. And then at the end of the research, this deal was done with AstraZeneca, under which that research was essentially privatized. And AstraZeneca said, you know, there's no question of this being a patent-free vaccine. We will own it, and we believe the Gates Foundation played some role in that decision too. So this initial idea that this would be a real people's vaccine, as soon as a big pharmaceutical company got into the picture, was off the agenda all of a sudden.
But they're not supposed to be making a profit, are they?
They're not supposed to be making a profit at the moment, but that, you know, that's within the pandemic, if you like. It's a special pandemic pricing structure that they've got. Although part of the problem is the huge amount of secrecy within the contracts that govern this mean that we don't exactly know how they calculate whether they're making a profit or not, and we don't know about the contracts they're signing with other companies in the developing world, which means that we've discovered that South Africa, for example, is paying double what the European Union is paying for their AstraZeneca vaccines.
So that's puzzling, because they can declare at a certain point that the pandemic is over. However they come to that conclusion, we don't know. And then they'll start banking money on the vaccines.
That's exactly our concern, yes. I mean, AstraZeneca have said that long-term, they won't make a profit off low-income countries. So, again, remains to be seen what they mean by that. But, you know, I'm not saying it's not a positive gesture in some senses, but bearing in mind this was initially a publicly developed vaccine, my question is, you know, why is it even within the gift of a big pharmaceutical corporation to say they'll be making a profit or they won't be making a profit for this long or that long? And as I say, the secrecy with some of these contracts is deeply problematic, because it means we can't hold them to account.
So a lot of people don't know, unless you've been living in Britain and reading the newspapers here, the reason is that we have the vaccine is because of capitalism, because of greed, my friends. That's what Prime Minister Boris Johnson told Conservative MPs. He didn't deny that, as far as I know. That came out in the newspapers. And then right after saying that, because of greed, he said, forget I said that. So what the heck is that all about? Is that revealing, or is this just some stupid remark that he's famous for?
Always difficult to know with Boris Johnson, but I think in this case it is revealing. And indeed, he said something similar. He didn't use the word greed, but he said something similar at Tory Party Spring Conference over the weekend as well. You know, that capitalism and big pharma has brought us to this stage. And look, of course, we're not denying that scientists have done a fabulous job over the last year of developing this vaccine. But by and large, they have developed it on the back of an enormous mobilization of public resources from Britain, slightly less from Europe, but still something significant there. And of course, from the United States in huge quantities. Public resources have developed it. Here in Britain, my argument is the NHS, a public body, has rolled out this vaccine and is largely responsible for getting it into our arms as fast as possible and efficiently as possible. Trial participants around the world who've had no profit for incentive whatsoever have helped this research get to this stage. So I just think he's simply wrong. And I think, you know, actually,
it's wrong that they make money, or it's wrong that they, that Britain is hoarding the vaccine and now Europe is going to block the vaccine. And you like, what is your thrust here?
My thrust is that Johnson, when he says it's capitalism that's done this, is wrong. It's society that's done it. It's public institutions that have done it. And then they have handed over this fabulous work to Big Pharma, some of whom have said they won't make a profit in the pandemic, all well and good, but they will still own these products for 20 years, which is plenty of time to make a substantial amount of money. And some of these companies, like Pfizer, for example, are already making phenomenal profits. And Moderna, we've just heard this week, right? Moderna is coming online in this country in a couple of weeks' time. Okay, all good. This was a vaccine made entirely with public money. And yet Moderna's corporate executives have made hundreds of millions of dollars off this through share sales.
So what position do you take on this tug of war that we've seen between Europe, you're part of Europe as well, between the European Union and Britain? Britain left the EU. Britain signed contracts before Europe did. Britain was able to get the bulk of the AstraZeneca assembly line pointed at it, so it's done very well with vaccines. It may have bungled the rest of the pandemic. It's got a terrible death rate, but it's done very well with vaccines. Now Europe says, wait a minute, we were naive. That's the language they use. And they are clawing back and threatening to block some of the exports of the AstraZeneca, which is made in places in Europe. So who is... Is there somebody on the wrong side of that, or is this just a normal tug of war, as one would expect? People want as many vaccines as they can get.
I think it's an inevitable consequence of a system where we basically said it's a free-for-all, buy as many as you possibly can of this limited supply, and we'll see who gets the most. There's no question the British government has done a good job at getting this vaccine into people's arms as fast as possible, and the European Union has done a less good job. There are many complex reasons for that, for the way the different political blocs went about accessing these vaccines. We'll see if at the end of, you know, the next year, it's still looks like Britain has done a really great job and the European Union's done a terrible job. I don't know yet, but I just think it's an inevitable consequence of a system which depends upon, you know, people buying the vaccines as fast as they possibly could, rather than a fair distribution system. I mean, I'm not gonna pretend that the European Union's done a good job in many instances, because clearly it hasn't, and I'm particularly dismayed about the way some European leaders have gone about kind of really questioning the efficiency of some of the vaccines. The AstraZeneca one in particular, I think, has been really damaging, you know, given that we've got real vaccine skepticism in some of our countries in Europe. But nonetheless, I don't think either side comes out of this looking particularly good, to be honest. And Britain can moan about vaccine nationalism and export restrictions and so on. The fact is, it signed a load of contracts that basically said us first. So it doesn't need to impose export restrictions in order to keep the vaccines here. So I think both sides are kind of, you know, come out not looking great.
Domestic audiences, the ones that vote, will applaud that and say, yeah, let's look after the rest of the world, but look after ourselves first. And they'll look at the British government and say, you know, applause your way, because we got a vaccine in our arm months before somebody else did. But in an article that you wrote, the reason why I asked for your interview is because you make the fundamental point that if people don't understand this, they better start digesting it right now. The immediate consequence of this is prolonging of the pandemic, as coronavirus, quoting you, is allowed to run rampant in poorer countries, taking countless lives along the way. And if people, Nick, don't care about those poorer countries, they better understand that the virus will mutate in those countries. The variants will come back and defeat the very vaccines that everybody is touting that they got in first world countries first.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, you know, on one hand, it's just a kind of moral obscenity that while we're all able to be vaccinated and people like me with no underlying health conditions and not at the highest level of risk from this pandemic are being given vaccines ahead of, you know, health workers and really vulnerable populations in other parts of the world. That for me is morally very problematic. But yeah, like you say, even if you don't care about that, we're a very, very globally interconnected country. The idea that we can just kind of pull up the drawbridge and sit here happy while it goes on spreading in other parts of the world is ultimately not going to serve our interests at all. And there's been research that's been done that shows, by the Gates Foundation, for example, that shows if you were to give this out in a fair way, a reasonably proportional way around the world, you would save many, many, many more lives than if some countries were able to buy up all of the vaccines in one go.
But whenever political leaders are asked about this, they always say, well, we contribute to COVAX. We contribute to the UN program for the fair distribution of vaccines in poorer countries. Would you say that that's just horse?
Fine, great that you contribute to COVAX. The problem is COVAX has no vaccines to buy at the moment, or not enough. So they can have the money in the bank account, fine, but they can't actually purchase them, and because they don't exist at the moment. And look, here's where you get to a real crux in this argument. I do think Britain should now start donating some of its vaccines. I think at the point where we were vaccinating health workers and really vulnerable parts of our population, nobody was saying we should be giving those vaccines away, like get that done, sure. But at the same time, you have way more than you need here. You know you're going to have way more than you need by the end of the year. We now do need to start donating some of those. However, that's not actually the main point of what we're campaigning on. The main point of what we're campaigning on is that essentially you have a system that the whole pharmaceutical system is based around this intellectual property rules, governed from the World Trade Organization to the TRIPS agreement, that is artificially limiting supply because it's preventing companies, manufacturers all around the world being able to produce because they don't have the intellectual property to do it. Unless they do a deal with one of these big pharma companies that own some of the vaccines, they can't produce. So you've got factories lying idle all around the world. This just makes no sense.
And I think answer is give up the suspend the intellectual property rules.
Suspend the intellectual property rules and share the know-how. And I think it's really interesting that over this weekend, apparently even Joe Biden in the White House was considering this. He was saying, look, this is going to actually be a real problem for global economic recovery. Also, I mean, if you just want to look at self-interest, America and the West are now losing out to China and Russia in terms of vaccine diplomacy because they're giving out their vaccines at a higher rate than we are. You know, so there's lots of reasons why you might want to do this.
America has over a billion vaccines. A billion vaccines, three times what they need, more than that.
Yeah, incredible. And again, I mean, everyone would say, okay, great job at vaccinating your own population, but what's the cost of that long term to the rest of the world and even therefore to your own economy? And so we believe that's something that they are actively looking at the moment. And I think when you put that to people, it's not just about, you know, donating your supplies. That might be a small part of it. It's about allowing other countries just to share this know-how that, for goodness sake, has been created in the first place with a massive mobilization of public resources. Most people are just like, well, it's kind of unanswerable, really. Yeah, why wouldn't we do that?
Nick Dearden with Global Justice Now. Nick, thank you so much for being generous with your time.
That's a pleasure.
All right. Jutta Pallas is a member of European Parliament from Germany's Green Party, and she joins us from, where are you?
Neustadt an der Weinstraße. This is very complicated to pronounce for an Englishman, I know. It's in the southwest of Germany, close to the French border.
I'm so glad you said that. You're right. I would have had trouble with it. And it's great to meet you. And I'm wondering if you could shed a bit of light on this row between the European Union and the United Kingdom, because reading it from Britain, they tend to play the victim in this, that they were the smart country, that they signed contracts before the EU, and that the EU bungled their rollout of vaccines, and now the EU is engaging in what amounts to a vaccine blockade.
Actually, I would not say there's a row between the EU and the UK. There's a row between the EU and AstraZeneca, which is a difference, I would say, because we're perfectly on the same page, for example, when it comes to BioNTech-Pfizer. BioNTech-Pfizer does export rather a large amount of vaccines produced in the EU to the UK, and we're perfectly fine with this because Pfizer, BioNTech-Pfizer, is fulfilling their contract with the EU. So basically, it's a difficulty with AstraZeneca because, to my understanding, they have sold their doses twice. And actually, I would like to make a little distinguishment here. As far as I know, the contract between the EU and AstraZeneca was signed one day before the contract between the UK and AstraZeneca was signed. But I don't think it really matters on which date that happened. I mean, AstraZeneca has promised they will do their best efforts to deliver, and they have signed a contract stating that there are no contracts which run against this promise. So basically, it's a row between the EU and one company.
So you don't think that the European government is really to blame for this, when only 14% of the population in the EU have received the vaccine, and 48, I mean, you know, basically half the United Kingdom have received their vaccines. And the EU at one point said they didn't even, they suspended the use of the AstraZeneca over health concerns that the UK said were unfounded to begin with. AstraZeneca said as well.
Well, it was some member states that suspended the use of AstraZeneca, mine included. I said on the day that it happened, I said, this is utter madness, because if you look at the incidence of the blood clots happening, people who say, I will not take this vaccine because of this risk, they better look in their bathroom cupboard whether they have some aspirin in there, because the riot syndrome is just as it has the same incidence. The riot syndrome is a very serious side effect which might happen when you take aspirin. It occurs very, very rarely. And I doubt if anyone who takes aspirin for a headache or for a cold or whatever has ever had concerns about this happening to him or her. So basically, what the EMA did, they said, don't stop vaccination. We will have a look at this. We will not suspend the authorization of the vaccine. But of course, we will have to assess the data, and we will have to improve the, I don't know the English word. And when you vaccinate a person, you have to tell them all about the risk that's associated and about the side effects, which will happen.
It's so full disclosure of all of the medical information that's available.
Yeah, yeah. So what they did is, please, dear doctors, tell your patients if they have symptoms like this and that, they should immediately go to a doctor. But anyway, that's all they did.
So finally, the European Union said, okay, AstraZeneca is okay, and they've started distributing it. And now they're saying that they will not allow some of those vaccines to leave the European Union for Britain, despite the fact that that may hold up Britain's second dose.
Yes, and I don't think that's a good decision, because, as said, we have the problem with AstraZeneca. By restricting the rollout of the vaccine in other countries, be it the UK, be it Canada, be it whatever country, we will not fight the pandemic. We will not increase the doses being available. And we will, on the contrary, foster trade wars, which will harm ourselves.
But so, how do you do it, Jutta? Like, do you just leave it to the vaccine companies? Do you leave it to individual states? Do you leave it to the United Nations? I mean, who is going to decide there are limited amounts of vaccines? Who gets them first? Where do they go?
Well, what I would do is take AstraZeneca to court, as simple as that. And if they're not ready to distribute the doses which they produce more fairly, then they would have to pay for that. Very sorry, you cannot promise your doses twice. And if you do so, you should be held accountable. So, but what I'm actually being really in favor of, and unfortunately neither the EU member states, with the exception of Poland, which came out today or yesterday, nor the UK are taking a stance on is that we need compulsory licensing, because with compulsory licensing, of course, the companies would have to be reimbursed for their patents. But with compulsory licensing, we could really ramp up vaccine production throughout the world. And this is so necessary. I mean, we are talking about the public health crisis.
Compulsory licensing, if I can interrupt, you mean that they should remove the patents and let everybody produce those vaccines around the world?
Right. And so this is something that Mr. Guterres has called for. I mean, I'm not talking about removing patents on all medicines forever. I'm talking about this specific public health crisis. We are talking about a pandemic. No one is safe until everyone is safe. The UK has already said we might need a third dose due to the variants, which are bred in Brazil and elsewhere. So we will not all not be safe unless everyone in the world is vaccinated.
There are some 85 countries that right now have no vaccines.
Right. And the COVAX program is short of vaccines because India said our people have to be vaccinated first. So we are not sending out the doses that were meant to support the COVAX program to vaccine in Africa and other countries. And so in Africa, we have health systems collapsing because the healthcare professionals are falling sick of COVID and eventually dying.
Yeah, it's just not a moral discussion about sharing with third world countries. In the end, it will come back to bite us all, don't you think? Because these variants will spread in those countries and our vaccines will be outpaced by the new variants. And this is just going to be a very dangerous, vicious circle of a continued pandemic that should have been brought to its knees much earlier.
Right. And we will not solve those problems with or export bans or vaccine nationalism.
I want to ask you one other thing before I let you go, and I appreciate your time. And that is, I know you've written about this whole idea of vaccine passports. And, you know, in the UK, the Prime Minister has come out and said, yeah, you know, probably you need a vaccine passport to go to a pub. And that a bar or pub or restaurant would have the legal right under their licensing and private property civil law to say, you can come in, but you cannot. And how do you feel about that?
I think it's very important that a pub owner or a retail store has the right to say, I want to protect the health of my other customers. I cannot let just everybody in. But what's important is you have to have an alternative option because there are people that cannot be vaccinated. I have a, well, let's call it distant relative, and she has a very rare disease and she cannot be vaccinated due to this disease. Or let's take children of 12 years. They cannot be vaccinated because up to now, we don't have a vaccine which is authorized for the use in children. So what are you going to do? Are you going to keep kids out of restaurants forever, or we restrict travel to kids so that family can go on holidays, but only without their kids? So that won't work. So we need an alternative approach. And that approach, of course, has to be the test.
Has to be the test.
So if you have a negative PCR test, ideally, then you should be treated equally to a vaccinated person. All the more because we are not sure, up to now, we are not sure whether vaccination provides the so-called sterile immunity so that vaccinated people cannot pass on the disease. This is relatively clear, I'd say, for Pfizer-BioNTech, according to the data they gathered in Israel, but it's not clear for the AstraZeneca.
Are you also worried about how you prove that you had a test or you prove that you had a vaccine? Do you have a piece of paper? Do you have a card in your wallet? Do you have an app on your phone, and who holds that health information and who shares that health information?
Right. There are some serious privacy issues which must be tackled there. And for us, it's important that you're not enforced having a digital certificate, because there are some people that don't even have a smartphone, right? So they should be They should have another option. Of course, we need a verification instrument, and the pirates in our group in the European Parliament have a very elaborated approach on public, private key, whatever. I was like, okay, you're the experts here. I trust you. If you say that's possible, that you can verify the this certificate, be it a vaccine certificate or a test certificate, through this means without sharing personal data, that's fine with me if that works. But of course, we have to make sure that not anyone stores private data from every customer in his or her system without being authorized. I wouldn't want to have a restaurant or public transport storing my data just because I entered a train.
Are you concerned, last word to you, about the next chapter in this? You are in a third wave in Europe. Britain is starting to reopen, but I think they're probably going to have to close again at a certain point as the wave comes in this direction. We're in this for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how long this will last, because we are seeing increasing cases of the P1 variant from Brazil, where it is not sure how strong vaccination works against P1. And so I'm a bit optimistic, because we will, in the EU, we will see a lot more vaccine doses coming to us in the second quarter. Johnson & Johnson now being approved. They said they will start rolling out their doses at from 15th April. Pfizer BioNTech opened the Marburg factory, rolling out 2.5 million doses per day. So we will have more doses in the second quarter, but no one knows which mutations might still come. And I think we might widen our view a bit and look at what the East Asian countries have done without any vaccination yet, eradicating the virus.
Zero COVID.
And it's not only the islands. It's Vietnam. It's Thailand. You can't say Vietnam is an island. Vietnam is no island. So yeah, it is possible, but you have to get going someplace.
Talk to a lot of epidemiologists who say zero COVID. But you know that the majority of society is not going to go along with an extended shutdown, and they're not going to go along with that, even if that means repeated shutdowns rather than one big one, repeated shutdowns over time of economies. We're in a very tough situation.
Yes, but I'm not sure whether people would not say, okay, let's have it once real hard, but then be over. Because they're seeing how people go to the full stadiums in New Zealand, how people go to summer holidays in Australia, how people have their life back to normal. There's virtually no restrictions except for the background testing. And of course, if you have an outbreak in a city, then they are super strict and super strong, but they're just closing down everything for 5 days.
Look and at the demonstrations that you've had in Germany already. I mean, people have been very resistant to any of the closings, and they're resistant to even taking the vaccines, many of them.
Yeah, I know. And it's even worse in France. And I mean, I come from science, and I'm always like, what are you guys thinking? So
You were a pharmacist, right? I should mention.
I'm a pharmacist, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
so naturally, I'm pretty confident when it comes to vaccines, right?
Jutta Paulus, a member of the European Parliament from Germany for the Green Party. So it's very kind of you to give us your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dana. It was a pleasure talking to you.
And that's our backstory on vaccines and COVID-19. Please share this podcast link and subscribe if you haven't already. If you want to leave comments or story suggestions, subscribe to our newsletter, danalewis.substack.com, and let me know your thoughts. I'm Dana Lewis. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.